Session number 14806.
Mr. Eddie Murray, side 21. Right, we've covered the uniform that was worn.
Except that we also had a heavy overcoat that we wore during the cold periods.
Really?
And that was the typical Legion uniform, which for 1 month was buttoned to the left, and for the next month, alternative months, was buttoned either to the left or to the right. And the flaps were always lifted up to give freedom to the knees, shall we say. And that was worn during the heavy period, and the cummerbund was worn over the caput rather than underneath.
This cummerbund was worn over the overcoat?
Over the overcoat, yes.
Right.
And of course, you mustn't forget that there were times, even in Indochina, when it was very, very cold indeed, especially at night, just like in the Saharan regions.
Mm. But actually, on the plains, it was cold, was it?
Really? Yes, yes.
What was the biggest variety in temperature that you had there? I mean, did it 90 to frost, or I don't know, I just wonder.
I can't remember having any frost, but there were hailstones. Mm. I remember hailstones. But I also remembered, you see, that most of the time from my kanya, my little cabin, if you like, in town, very, very frequently during the wet season, I would divest myself of all my clothes and just step out into the yard, and in the pouring rain, because it was so warm, you know, a lovely shower.
Yes.
Indeed.
Right. Okay. Did the Japanese, when you were bombing railways and so forth, or they were being bombed, did they take reprisals against people?
No, well, from what I can hear, they did take reprisals on villages that were in the vicinity, for instance, of places where there had been destruction caused. I think the idea was to make the natives inform the Japanese if they saw anything happening because of the fear of reprisals against them. But all in all, I don't think there was much reprisal. I feel absolutely certain that the Japanese were really waiting and expecting from 1 week to another their complete taking over of the whole of the country.
Okay.
And so little matters like reprisals, you know, was something that they were going to take care of at a later date, shall we say.
So it's held up the sleeve. Okay. But did you see any reprisals, or what was the feeling about reprisals?
No, I never saw any taking place.
Or, I mean, heard of them?
No, I can't say that I ever heard of any.
Okay. Just before going back to the United Kingdom, what was the general atmosphere in India, you know, leading up to VJ Day, then after VJ Day, demob sort of thing? Firstly, about going back to England and all the rest of it, and also what was going to be like in England, and what was the feeling about what would happen with India generally? So, I mean, what was the feeling round about VJ Day? You said it was a bit of a sort of anti-climax, as far as I could gather, compared with what's talked about VE Day.
Yes, I think that the majority of the of people were rather sorry that the war ended so suddenly against Japan, that is. I think the feeling was that most of the military personnel wanted really to sort of land in Japan and take reprisals for all the atrocities that they'd carried out. And so it was a bit of an anticlimax when suddenly, woof, you know, one day to another, the whole thing came to an end. And nobody knew what was going to happen. Were they going to be sent out to Japan? Like, for instance, I expected to be sent to Japan. And I was informed that I would be. You know, and that was, I think, one of the reasons why they said that I couldn't have a birthday party on the 18th, because I was due to be shipped out to Japan. I don't know what for, but it never happened. But as far as the population were concerned, you must remember that there had been quite a number of, from what I heard, quite a number of Indian, perhaps companies, maybe regiments, that had gone over to the Japanese side and marched through Burma or something like that. How they got to the Japanese, I don't know how they did it, but it was a well-known fact that there were Indian regiments fighting alongside the Japanese against the British. And this was a fact. And so there was a movement, it was understood that there was a movement of antagonism towards the Raj, if you like, and the British going on throughout the whole of India, and particularly in Calcutta. And it was a known fact that there were organizations even then, at that time, forming, getting themselves organized for an eventual takeover from the British.
What did the British themselves make, think, what was the feeling that the probably unspoken of what they thought might
No, the majority happen. Of British thought that it was unheard of, that this could never happen, that we would abandon the subcontinent. But then, of course, Gandhi came into it, and Pandit Nehru and the rest of them, and it could be seen that they were organizing, there were huge meetings and huge demonstrations, and the police, of course, there was the Indian police as well, but they were loath to take proceedings. I know they used their latties on occasion.
And the British is a big
one of those long cane
for beating crowd control
that the police carried, for crowd control, and that they did use that, but they were, you know, they were not competent to deal with the size of the riots and demonstrations that were taking place. And so even a blind man could see, or a deaf man could see, that there was definitely a big, big movement in favour of the expulsion of the British.
But the, why did the British think that, do you think in particular, felt that India would be a permanent fixture?
I think the majority of British people in India, they thought they were there for the mental the apocalypse.
Did they think the Indians were up to running themselves?
No, no one ever thought that the Indians were capable, and that was the whole reason why they thought that we'd be forever in India, because they were incapable of ruling themselves. I think that future events almost proved it. Really.
Well, many.
Oh yes, of course. Forgot about that. It's just a thought that I had, a personal thought at the time, you know.
What was the, I mean, the atomic bomb, I mean, nobody had ever heard of that. I mean, what was the,
that was
what was the, I mean, what was the reaction to that? It was a new dimension. I mean, it was...
Absolutely, and so we knew nothing at all about it. All we did hear was that, of course, I'm talking about the ordinary man in the street. I'm not, this is not my, this is not from the interior of the clandestine intelligence movement. This is, you know, I'm talking particularly about the man in the street who had no knowledge at all about atomic bombs. And the actions, all they knew was that something had happened in Japan and the war was over. And they
so we're
wondered
talking about the rest of the British troops. We're talking,
yes, talking about the troops. Of course, I had access to the British troops, and every time I wanted the jeep, for instance, I had to go to the transport officer, and little blow, and so then, of course, there was always contact between us and the local British troops.
And what I'm saying is the reaction of the ordinary troops and officers didn't they couldn't quite fathom it, but they couldn't quite fathom it, but they accepted it. Is that
there? Well, it was accepted as one of those things.
What did you and your colleagues make of it, and how did you actually hear? You perhaps heard in slightly greater detail than the rest.
Yes.
So, what, you got a signal, or you got a, what, how did that...
Well, I had a signal from Calcutta down to the training camp telling me that it was imminent.
What, that the bomb was imminent?
that the end of the war was imminent.
Right.
But they didn't ever, you know, we were never told or never, they never enlarged upon the fact that the war was over. It was in the newspaper, it was on the radio and that sort of thing, that they dropped what was called an atomic bomb.
Right, and that was published completely as an atomic bomb at the time.
At the time.
Mm-hmm. And did it, nobody really knew what it was except that it was a very, very big explosion.
Mm-hmm. No, I suppose they compared it to so many thousands of tons of TNT.
Right,
and
okay. What did people, the general feeling about Britain and so forth, about what it would be like? No, you have to correct me. When did Churchill lost the election? He lost the election in...
In 45, just later that year.
Wait, was that before or after VJ Day?
After VJ Day.
After VJ Day. And what was the general feeling about returning to England? Because I mean, most of the people, I imagine, had been away from England for quite some time. Or what England would be like after the war.
I'm just thinking about it. I'm sure it was after VJ Day. Memory. That's one of those things that times and dates.
Yes.
You know, I've never given a lot of paid a lot of attention to that, except where there were, I was intimately concerned in the business. And here we are. You see, I'm out in Japan, and one thought was in my mind at the time that I was going to Japan, being sent to Japan. And then came along, can't have my birthday. And then, you know, the war's over. I'm not going to Japan. No, I'm going back to England.
Right, okay. So let's go, shall we go on to the back to England? You're on a troop ship.
Yes, on
a senior civilian passenger.
That was one thing they paid for, was a first class passage back to England.
Right.
And I wouldn't have been surprised if they'd, you know, bought a train ticket, first class train ticket back to Hanoi for me, something like that. Yeah. So I was disappointed, really, in their attitude. And then, of course, I'd blocked my copybook, hadn't I?
Yeah.
And that was so disappointing as far as my own personal feelings were concerned.
Yes.
But there are lots and lots of things going on at the time, do you see? And on the train, yes, of course, my French girlfriend saw me off at Howrah Station. I remember that well. And that long, long journey, I couldn't tell you for the world of me how long it
this
took.
This was to where?
To Karachi.
To Karachi?
Right across.
From Calcutta to Karachi?
Yes.
Must have been a week.
Was
or
it Karachi?
So. I don't know.
Well, right across the continent.
Or where did the steamer go from then?
I feel it was Karachi.
Okay.
I'm sure it wasn't Bombay, which is right at the bottom of India, if I feel right. But it was more or less straight across the continent. I'll have a look at the map and tell you where it was. But I know we picked up the SS Strathmore there. And it was, I'm sure it took 3 days. To get there, three or four days to get there.
Yeah.
And it was so absolutely boring. And I, you know, I was travelling first class. I can't remember anybody that was on the train or where we stopped, except that it was terribly boring and that most of the train was taken over by Indians, either on the running boards, if you like, of the train or on the roof.
Mm. Okay.
This was something that happened all over India, I'm sure. And how more people didn't die, I can't understand it at all.
And you went to,
the port of Karachi, I'm sure it
and
was.
And then you're on the train, on the boat?
On the boat.
Yeah.
And then I was lucky, you see, because I had two tin trunks with me, which I had picked up in Calcutta, containing my effects, but containing also gifts, for instance, nylon stockings, for instance, for my mother and any other friends. And I knew my brother was married. My brothers were married. And my sisters were married during the time that I'd been away, in fact, you know. And so I had to take some presents there. But I also had half a dozen bottles of gin, half a dozen bottles of whiskey, and a half a dozen bottles of
something else,
wine, I suppose.
Yeah.
But that I had purchased, having been told, of course, that all troop ships were dry.
Right.
And so I had prepared for this
eventuality. Were you able to do that bit as you were the mess manager?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Yes.
No doubt about it. I suppose that's what...
Yes.
It was quite relevant as far as the deficit was concerned at the end. But I didn't mind.
Right. No. And so you managed to have a... Did you have a cabin on your own, or you had to share, or...? Well, anyway.
Did you have a cabin,
is the question.
I shared a cabin with the chief fire officer of the fire station at Ilford.
Oh, really?
And in the next cabin was another one of his fire officers. And I don't know, they'd been on an instruction course, I think, instructing the Indians, you know,
right,
what to do in cases of big fires.
Mm.
And then Jimmy Horrocks was just along the road too. Jimmy Horrocks became a personal friend of mine. He was with the Office of Information at the time. And then he was eventually in England. He went over to the Times and then to the Hickey column of the Daily Express.
Okay.
And died about 3 years later.
Uh-huh.
Three or four or five years ago.
Uh-huh.
So there was Jimmy Horrocks. And then there was also this wonderful singer, Margaret Burton.
Uh-huh.
And she died... Oh, 30 or 40 years ago, as a matter of fact. And she was a wonderful contralto, well known to such an extent that there was an obituary in the Telegraph,
right,
in the Times. So, she did perform on board for the troops, and we used to have fun, but particularly we used to have parties in my room, in my cabin, or our cabin, because I had the drink. Nobody else had any drink.
Master at arms, or whoever it might have been, object to this revelry on a dry ship?
First class passengers were first class passengers and immune to any of that sort of thing, especially civilians.
We
were civilian. And so we had quite a lot of nice parties, and I remember, yes, taking drinks up to the. And I can see the piano there with Margaret, singing to us. But I know that I was very, very popular, and I wonder occasionally if it was only because of the drink. You know, I feel not, because we kept in touch, and I've still got a 1,000 yuan Chinese note signed by the five of us.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. Okay. And so you went... you returned to England 18 bottles lighter, presumably.
It was quite uneventful, really,
yeah,
the trip. And we went through the Suez Canal, and we saw the boats that had been sunk by NASA.
Really, at that time?
Was it NASA? But I know there were sunken ships in the Suez Canal. It couldn't have been NASA. That happened probably happened later.
Mm.
Worth checking on. Mm. But I know there were ships that were sunk in the Suez Canal. And then... Just as we came through past Alexandria, it was discovered that by the doctor that one of the passengers had... It wasn't typhoid, it wasn't typhus, it wasn't malaria. It was, another...
Tropical disease.
Another disease, not a tropical one.
TB?
No.
Huh?
I know there's an EA in it. Something
diphtheria.
Like Swansea, no? Stupid. Well, had a disease that was
communicable.
And so we went towards Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
No, Malta.
Malta.
Sorry. We went to Malta to deposit this case.
Mm-hmm.
And got rid of him. And then immediately carried on, you see, through the Mediterranean and back to England. We didn't even call into Gibraltar or anything like that.
Mm.
And I thought it was rather strange that we should really have stopped at Gibraltar or something like that for food supplies. But nevertheless, we got to Southampton. And there, we were informed on the tannoy system, when we arrived late afternoon, mm-hmm. that nobody was allowed ashore because of the disease that somebody had had.
Yeah.
Not right, well, it wasn't
polio.
No.
Oh, well, I don't
Another
know.
One of these spotty diseases.
Smallpox.
Smallpox, that was it. Sorry, I couldn't
right.
do that.
The food in India, there was no rationing or anything, was there, in India?
Not to my knowledge, no. Okay. And the bazaars and the markets were all open. And as I said, we had the best food in the whole of India, really,
and
at our place.
On the ship? There was no rationing?
On the ship, I can't remember.
Yeah.
There didn't appear to be any rationing at all.
And
yes, there must have been rationing on the ship. I know that the food was quite palatable and acceptable without being, haute cuisine.
Mm.
But as I said, I can't remember. There was nothing at all happened on the boat except that we had quite a good time.
And you were now fully in contact with your family?
Oh, yes, I'd been receiving letters and sending letters off, mainly by these airmail blue letters.
Yes.
You know.
And were you were your family expecting you? They knew when you were going to arrive?
Ah.
Right.
Now, here we are.
So.
Now, this is one of the most remarkable things that ever happened to me. We got to Southampton, you see. Now, coming through the Suez Canal, I'd sent a cablegram, a Marconigram, it was called, from the boat, to my brother at the police station in, I remembered he was PC712 and was at Stoke Newington.
Mm.
And so I sent him a Marconigram from the ship to Stoke Newington police station, telling him of the time, the estimated time of arrival in Southampton. And I, prepare fatted calf, is what I said. Prepare fatted calf, Southampton and such a date and the name of the boat. So there we are, landed in Southampton. Nobody allowed ashore because of this. We had to be cleaned, declared clean, you see. And so that was on the tannoy system. And the porters were on strike the next morning, because we stayed overnight. But and so we knew that the porters were on strike in Southampton, specifically for the Strathmore. Right, so I wash my hands, go down to my cabin, and on the way to my cabin, I had a feeling that I heard the name of Murray mentioned on the tannoy system. But it was, pretty poor system at any time. And so I washed my hands and went towards my cabin. And there, standing at my cabin door, was a person in civvies, smoking a pipe, looking very respectable. And I said to myself, I don't know him. I'm sure he wasn't in the first class compartments, traveling first class on the boat. Now, I wonder what he wants. And so I put my hand on the doorknob, you see, to go into my cabin. And he said, "Mr. Murray." And so I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm Inspector Brown of the Special Branch of Metropolitan Police Force here in Southampton." Oh, me remembering the stockings and all the rest of it. And he said, "Mr. Murray," he said, "your brother's on shore and wants to know if it'll be all right for him to come aboard." This was at 6 o'clock in the evening, so I said, "Well, of course." We shook hands, and he told me he was from the special branch on port duty at Southampton. And so off he went and brought my brother on board. And I was able to give my brother, quite a number of, because he was, as I said, he was at the police station, at Stoke Newington police station, so he was a copper, although he was in civvies. And I was able to pass quite a lot of silk stockings over to him, And that was all right. We had a drink and we...
So you got off the ship?
No, I'm on the ship.
Right.
I'm on the ship.
Right.
And this is about 6 o'clock in the evening of the day of our arrival. And so, he said,
It must have been a reunion just to see your brother then.
Oh, it was a great reunion, yes. But my brother was never demonstrative.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah, well, I mean, he was a very, very good policeman.
Right.
And so there was no great demonstration. But he said, right, see you tomorrow morning. Okay, Tom, and I escorted him to the gangway, and off he went. And there's no movement ashore at all of porters or anything. Mm. Quite a lot of movement of health officials, if you like. Now, there's a train that starts in the dockyard, and there's a train that starts up at the central station, you see, and it's not terribly far. Right, next morning, as I said, nobody, no luggage was going ashore. People, I think, if I remember rightly, were able to go ashore, but they were told that the train wouldn't be leaving before, shall we say, 10 o'clock. And so there's my brother on the shore, you see, so I say goodbye to my friends, and off I go. I've got my certificate of identity, if you like, and I present this, and a thing saying that I was allowed to leave India, and stamped, and so I produced these, and I was allowed ashore where my brother was, and got me luggage off. We carried it off, these tin trunks and everything, which was quite a procedure. And then Tom said, hang on a minute, and he went, and a couple of uniformed dock policemen came up with trolleys, and we loaded my luggage onto the trolleys. And then he said, now the train leaving from the station here, this was, I suppose, 8:30 or something like this, he says it leaves at 10 o'clock, but he said the train from the central station leaves at 9:30, we'll go and catch that one. And the police officers pushed the trolleys up to the central station, and we got on there, you see, embarked onto this train.
But you didn't have an immigration or anything like that at all?
Oh, I suppose we went through. No. Tom had all fixed all this up, and all arranged.
And nobody else left the ship.
And nobody else left the ship, to my knowledge. So there we are on the train. Now, you understand that I'd only told Tom, and Tom had told nobody else. Yes, he affirmed that he'd told nobody else. We were going to his place, which is at West Ewell in Surrey. No, we were going back to my mother's place in Acton. But nobody knew about my arriving. Nobody knew that we were not going to take the 10 o'clock train. We were going to take the 9:30 train, which left 30 minutes early. Mm. Might have been 3/4 hour, but see, nobody knew any of these things, except Tom, and that was in situ, that was there. So off we go to Waterloo. Landed at Waterloo, all the luggage. We put the heavy luggage into the left luggage place. We were going to collect it by car the next day. So that's all right. So we've got hand luggage, quite a reasonable amount of hand luggage, and we come out of Waterloo Station and go for the underground station to go up to Acton, do you see? Acton.
What did you make of all this? Oh, you hadn't seen England or a tube train for a decade nearly.
This is coming home. This is the homecoming. But the actual homecoming is going to be at Acton.
Right.
So we get onto the escalator going up with our luggage. And then, coming down on the other side, on the other escalator, my mother.
Really?
She'd looked in the newspaper and found out that the only thing arriving, you see, from India, she knew that I was probably coming that day, you see, Tom had probably told her that. But no details at all. And she'd found out that the train from Southampton Harbour was landing at Waterloo at such and such a time. So she'd come for the 10 o'clock train, and here we are passing on the escalator,
right,
going from Waterloo station up to the underground station. What a remarkable
Incredible.
Thing.
Incredible. So you caught up with her to say?
Well, of course, we waited at the top, and then she just took the escalator up, and there we were.
Right.
And then we took the underground as far as Acton Town, and there, you know, a taxi along to where Julian Avenue.
So did you have a party, or what? It must have been an incredible moment after 10 years, roughly.
I think it was, remember, this is 1946, and there's lots and lots of restrictions in Britain.
Yeah, it was still 45,
food and all the rest of it.
It was early 46, was it?
Well, early 46, you see, January 46.
Right.
And so there were still a lot of restrictions, even about petrol and rationing it was all.
And was that was a very cold winter, or was it 48 was a very cold winter? But anyway, you hadn't been in a European winter for some considerable time.
No. So, I can't remember anything about it.
Okay.
Except that I was home.
Right.
And I was in my mother's place. And my brother was at living in West Ewell with his wife and family. And shortly afterwards, he was transferred to Scotland Yard, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And the other brother was a short distance away at Acton. He was in the fire brigade. And he also had a wife and family. So my mother was on her own.
Right. Your father?
My father died during the Blitz.
Really?
In London.
How did you find out about that? That your father died in
the
Blitz?
Oh, that's a good one, yes. That was the first information that I got from London, from the London head of the intelligence office, transmitted to me in Calcutta.
Right, I see.
That my father had died during the war.
Right.
You know, they said.
Right. How much news generally had you got from England? Because presumably from before the war, and certainly during the Vichy period, and then all the way through up until August 45 or July 45, you hadn't seen a paper, you didn't know anything.